Welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. I'm Dr. Z, and we're really excited to have with us Dr. James Greenblatt. And we're going to be bringing him on in a second. But first, to some announcements from some workshops that we're doing, myself and The Natural Nurse. Put this on your calendar. For September, we have our herbal workshop at Gilberti's Herbs in Westport, Connecticut. And that's going to be on September 17th of this year. And that's an exciting workshop where you learn to identify medicinal plants and then collect them and make medicines from them. So we're really excited to do that. So if you're in the Westport, Connecticut area on vacation or from Connecticut or around that area, New York, Long Island, Massachusetts, et cetera, come down and you can get more information on naturalnurse.com. The other workshop we're doing is our trip to Chinatown, New York City, to learn about alternative medicine and particularly Chinese medicine, you know, all the things that you could do to keep your immune system strong, all the things that we don't hear about on the mainstream news. They're more focused on, you know, vaccinate our way to health, which, you know, is one way, important way, certainly for public health. But that's not the end of the story with the germ theory. You know, there's also the theory of host resistance. And there's a lot of more proactive ways to live and things to do when it comes to, of course, your immune system health. So that's going to be on September 24th, that's Saturday. That's our annual trip to Chinatown, New York, to learn all about traditional Chinese medicine. So that's, again, go to naturalnurse.com and check the calendar for that. Onwards with our program with Dr. James Greenblatt. And he's so excited. I'm so excited to have him on again. He was our guest a while ago. And you can reach his website at jamesgreenblattmd.com or Psychiatry Redefined. And he's a pioneer in the field of functional and integrative medicine, a board certified child and adult psychiatrist. He's treated patients since 1988. He has received his medical degree and his psychiatric residency at George Washington University, and a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Medical School. And now he's the chief medical officer at Walden Behavioral Care in Dedham, Massachusetts. He is an international lecturer and writer and author of 7 books talking about nutritional interventions in psychiatry and mental illness. Some of his books, which you can get, are Answers to Anorexia, Finally Focus, the Breakthrough Natural Treatment for ADHD, and an upcoming book on functional and integrative medicine for antidepressant withdrawal. He is considered an orthomolecular psychiatrist. Maybe he can tell us about that. And founder of Psychiatry Redefined, a platform dedicated to transformation of psychiatry, which offers online courses, webinars, and fellowships for professionals. And you can visit again psychiatryredefined.com. But today we're going to be talking about an interesting mineral. Now, just a little background. You know, I've also have been teaching in medical schools for a quarter century. I just retired from teaching, and at the Naturopathic School in Bridgeport, Connecticut, I taught a course in nutrition and minerals, and I guess I was the functional medicine professor there teaching about that. And I always came across in my mineral analysis very curious mineral called lithium. And, you know, lithium is couched in mystique, and people think it's something that is, a dangerous medicine. And maybe there's a history of that that Dr. Greenblatt will talk about. But let's bring him on and let's talk about lithium. Hey, Dr. Greenblatt, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about the research on lithium. Lithium is an element on the periodic chart, and is it essential for human health?
I think, you know, lithium has these two very divergent paths. So we think of a lithium as a medication, a drug used for bipolar illness, and that's very high doses of the same element, lithium, called lithium carbonate. So that's the drug, which has a lot of stigma and a lot of side effects. But lithium is an element, as you said, it's in the Earth's crust, it's on the periodic table, and it's something you play with in chemistry class. And it is essential for human health. And it's just been very confusing because so much of our association with lithium is as a pharmaceutical, not as a natural element that's essential primarily for brain health.
Now, you talked about in a fantastic article that I read, and some of your information on your Psychiatry Redefined website, that lithium salts have been used for centuries as a popular health tonic with so many applications, i.e. foods, which I guess we call functional foods now, but they were kind of foods that people would use, and pop and soda and places to go where, you know, health destinations. Talk a little bit about the history of this fantastic mineral.
Sure. Some of the mineral spa baths going back, you know, the Romans and the Egyptians, and then in this country with the Native Americans, these are these mineral baths that were very, very high in lithium. And people would just, destination spas, and people would go for healing. And in the early 1900s, it was introduced into our foods as the drink 7-Up, the 7-Up soda, started as a lithiated soft drink. And just the name 7-Up, seven is close to the weight, the elemental weight of lithium, which is 6.94. So 7-Up was a drink that was a lithiated drink to lift your mood, up your mood. So it was in 7-Up for about 30 years, and it was sold on street corners to help with ailments, and hangovers was a big one in the early 1900s.
Wow. And then you even mentioned in your article that Sears and Roebuck also had lithium effervescent tablets for different afflictions, sort of like you put them in the water and they fizz, and you drink it and it somehow relieves some ailments, maybe the hangover possibly.
Yeah, it was, originally it was kind of the miracle cure for lots of things, and that's how it got in the culture. And but medicine at that time was just sold, you know, over the counter, and then it got into 7-Up, and then it wasn't until the late 40s where scientists were doing research and discovered by accident that lithium potentially was calming in animal studies, and then they started using it for bipolar with a pretty dramatic results at that time, you know, but we had no other medications for those afflicted with serious mental illness.
And then the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that a lot of us get lithium in the standard diet, but there's places in the country that the lithium is very low. I know that from measuring it all the time in patients. It's part of some of these standardized nutritional panels, and you see that some people have like lithium that's so low it's undetectable in the body. So it's considered a trace element, correct?
Yes, but what you mentioned, I think, is one of the most significant public health. Lithium is a natural element that is important for brain function. We can talk about some of those illnesses, but it, as you said, it varies based on your water supply. So where you live in one part of one state, the lithium varies tremendously. And we see this across the globe, and the varying degrees of lithium in the water supply, just those trace amounts in your tap water has profound implications for suicide risk, Alzheimer's, and psychiatric illness in general. And we have almost 50 years of research supporting this basic public health fact.
Now, do all people require lithium? Is there like a RDA or an optimal daily allowance, or has the government issued edicts on that, or is it still sort of in never land as far as their recommendations?
In terms of the government, it's in never land. In terms of scientists, it's pretty much classified as essential, that 1 to 2 milligrams a day is what's required, but there's not an RDA for lithium.
Okay, so then, and what about the variables, genetic variables and environmental variables, which might influence an individual's requirements for lithium? Do you find in your clinical practice and your scholarly work that sort of varies depending upon the patient? I've seen that many times. I've seen people where it goes up very rapidly in the body when you supplement and bring it back to somewhere in a decent level. And then sometimes they cycle through it very slowly. So it's very interesting how individually, when you look at the clinical nature of it, it varies quite extensively.
Yes, and that's been the basis of my work, is looking, I believe that there are individuals with certain genetic liabilities that have a higher need for lithium, the same way we see for every other nutrient. So some individuals have a higher need, and we also have varying degrees of how we metabolize and utilize it. So that is, to me, the big difference when we see these patients and family histories of substance abuse, of depression, of suicide. Those are the families that I have found just slight increase in this nutritional lithium can really make a difference in preventing some of these serious psychiatric illnesses.
Tell us a little bit about the use of lithium in medicine, like when they first started to see it working on, I guess you call them affective disorders. Maybe you can define that for the listeners.
Sure. I mean, lithium is shown to be initially helpful in what is called bipolar illness. So that is a mood disorder where somebody has these mood swings from very elevated, which we call manic, deep, and very energized, and fluctuating with very depressed moods associated with thoughts of suicide and inability to function. So it's those severe mood swings where lithium was found to be in the 60s or across Europe effective, and continues to this day to be the most effective treatment we have for bipolar illness.
They're swinging back and forth, you're saying, from depression to feeling elated, and what's the symptoms that people would experience with that?
The manic phase is not requiring sleep, oftentimes thinking of focused on religion, sexuality, grandiose plans, and then sometimes losing touch with reality. And then the depression is really a profound emotional numbness and not really being able to function. So it's those two swings that really have, very common in many famous people, creative artists, from Hemingway, to others. But in that manic phase, there is an intense creativity, and that depressed phase, the substance abuse and suicide is not uncommon.
Was lithium used as a medicine in ancient times in your readings? That did you ever read any? I mean, you talked about that people would go to spas in Greek, or maybe you mentioned the Romans. So did they know that there was, they probably didn't know about lithium per se, but did they just know that being exposed to certain air in particular caves and springs brought health?
Yeah, absolutely. And many of these have been shown to be high in lithium. Certainly the ones around this country, New York and Georgia, there are these lithiated springs. People would sometimes bring their bottles of water and fill up to get water, but also associated with health and healing, absolutely.
I remember reading something from the government in Texas saying that lithium had such profound effects on mental health that the governor wanted to put it in the water, just like they put fluorine in the water. Did you read that?
A number of psychiatrists have recommended it because when you go through the research, these micrograms in the tap water that you and I used to drink before bottled water took over the planet is associated with decreasing suicide risk, Alzheimer's and dementia risk, and psychiatric illness in general. So just as public health implications, there are a number of psychiatrists that wrote about it and a few politicians, but people are just, again, the stigma of lithium being this drug for bipolar illness really had quite a strong reaction from many people. So I'm not sure we'll ever get it in the water supply, though I'm a firm believer of these trace amounts would have profound public health implications for decreasing mental illness.
How did it get stigmatized? Is that just because mental illness is stigmatized in general?
Well, partly, and then I think early when it came out in the 40s, people in this country, instead of sodium chloride on the salt shaker, they developed lithium chloride to minimize salt because the salt was going to cause high blood pressure. So putting lithium on the table, there were like 6 or 7 deaths that happened in the United States. These were all associated with very sick heart disease patients. So that kind of put the fear in just adding lithium. And it was a concern because lithium as a drug can be toxic. So it's that fine line between that small amount that's essential and then high amount that can be toxic. But we're talking about the difference between, 1,800 milligrams versus 1 milligram.
Right, that's the Goldilocks principle that you adhere to, which is too much, too little versus just right. And I guess that's individual.
It's individual and based on family history, genetics, and where you live. Where is the water that you're drinking? Yes.
So it's important, I guess, to measure that before people use what you call low dose nutritional lithium. So there's a difference between, is there actual difference in the type of lithium that's used in the pharmaceutical lithium and the low dose nutritional lithium?
No, they're both the element, the lithium. It's what it's kind of bound with. So the prescription is lithium carbonate, and the typical nutritional lithium is a form called lithium orotate. So it's really just a carrier molecule, which is benign, has no kind of meaning in the body, but it's the lithium that is the element that has a physiological effect.
What is that effect, actually? Because lithium is like a close cousin to sodium, I believe, right? Like they're similar. And it's interesting that you mentioned that they substituted it for sodium at the dinner table. So that's kind of shows you how closely related it is. And I know sodium is very important for nerve impulses. They've developed a lot of pain modulating drugs based on the sodium potential or, you know, the axon potential going through our nervous system. Tell us a little bit about lithium and its relationship with the other minerals like sodium.
Sure. I mean, I think that the what we call the mode of action of lithium is just so comprehensive and it does so many things. And each year we learn more. But there are just hundreds of mechanisms of actions from affecting genes, so stimulating genes, to affecting neurotransmitters, to affecting inflammation. So there are just a host of mechanisms, and that's why it's been studied for such a broad range of both medical and psychiatric illnesses. It is really just mind-boggling to me all the effects that it has in the body, regulating both the genetic as well as other what we call second messengers that affect how the brain functions.
You were saying in one of your articles that they looked at Alzheimer's rates in 66 elderly patients that had bipolar disorder, and they found that the lithium was so important that patients who received the continuous lithium showed a decreased prevalence of Alzheimer's disease versus those in the non-lithium group. That's Nunes et al., 2007. And then you mentioned in Denmark, they did like 21,000. They looked at a retrospective study. They looked at that for those who received lithium, and there was definitely a decreased level of dementia and Alzheimer's. That's like Nobel Prize winning stuff, but I guess it's kind of hard to patent lithium because it's ubiquitous now. Cats outside.
You're right.
The bag,
yeah, it costs pennies a day, so there's no pharmaceutical company. And the research you mentioned, it initially was in prescription lithium, decrease Alzheimer's. And then they started looking at the same as the suicide risk, lithium in the water supply. And then there are recent studies looking at these trace amounts preventing cognitive decline from progressing to dementia. So it is just really remarkable of research with clinical implications, but pretty much ignored because of, I believe, the lack of, you know, pharmaceutical money making it popular.
And then some of the trials reported like they use lithium over a short period of time, relatively speaking, like 10 weeks, and the lithium didn't do anything or failed to show the efficacy. But you mentioned that many times it takes months, not weeks, to see substantial cognitive shifts in patients. What have you seen in your research and working with patients there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the research around cognitive decline, moving to dementia, Alzheimer's, most of the work says, you know, that you need to be on lithium for at least a year. I think in my work clinically, for over 30 years, been using lithium, what we see more quickly is the reversal of symptoms like irritability and anger. We've seen that in a couple weeks. So lithium helps with poor impulse control, and when that's associated with mood and irritability, we've seen that disappear in 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes dramatically.
And then cognitive scales, patients feel that they have improved performance on cognitive scales. What are the cognitive scales that they look for in these different studies when they're looking at dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
There are multiple kind of standard scales for cognitive decline that were used. Many of the studies use different scales, but these are all kind of research validated scales, so they could really notice the difference before and after treatment.
Right, right. And then there's something called the tau proteins that they look for as a marker in preventing dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Was lithium effective for those tau proteins, which is kind of like the universal marker? Of course, it's just one of many, many markers that, like, people have been looking for in dementia. It's so multifactorial, as you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what we know about Alzheimer's is that it doesn't appear overnight. It's almost a 30 to 40 year prodrome. So we know during those 30 or 40 years, there are multiple interventions that we can do to stop the progression of this illness. And two markers, two of the hallmark markers, is the accumulation of beta amyloid and this tau protein, which kind of junks up the cells in the brain so they don't work as efficiently. And we've spent billions of dollars looking at drugs to interfere with that process of the accumulation of beta amyloid and tau protein. And lithium has been shown, again, over many years to do both of those things. Lithium can prevent the accumulation of tau protein and beta amyloid. And actually, one of the longer studies was able to demonstrate, it was a four-year study, after year three, the beta amyloid was being removed from the body. Those that were taking lithium, they could actually remove it. So not only any scientist looks through the lithium literature, it is completely overwhelming how effective as a preventative measure lithium can be for dementia and Alzheimer's.
Now, we've known that for decades that they use, you pointed out too, a high dose of lithium, 1200 milligrams of the lithium carbonate for mental illness. Why are they using it at such a high level instead of using a low potency lithium?
Well, I think there's a pharmaceutical effect of the high dosages, and then there's a kind of nutritional preventative effect of lower dosages. So for bipolar illness, somebody in the throes of a major mental illness, either manic, then the higher doses are probably helpful. And I've been, you know, a psychiatrist for over 30 years treating bipolar illness, and lithium can be helpful. I think is that they maintain those high doses. I don't believe that's always necessary in someone's life because there's more side effects, you know, doing what we can to stabilize someone's illness and then using the lowest possible dose to support ongoing, what we call euthymic moods, even moods without side effects. And oftentimes a lower dose can be helpful.
So the low dose more is for anxiety and balancing the and even prevention of these sort of inflammatory type of things, but it's not really the one that is used to bring person down out crisis or something like that. Yeah, I think that's important to point out clinically.
Yes, absolutely.
Very good. So with the, you mentioned that there's a big push to develop Alzheimer's drugs, but there's not a big push on lithium. Do you think that that's pretty much financial, or is there a problem with the research on lithium that's not totally up to snuff with what the, you know, psychiatric, your colleagues in the psychiatric profession feel is enough evidence, or what's your thinking on that? Is it just pure financial?
I think it's financial. There is actually a drug company, I think based out of France, that's taking lithium as this mineral that, you know, costs pennies a day, and they're putting it in a form so they can patent it, you know, a more fat soluble thing. So once they can get a patented drug, then they're going to market it for Alzheimer's. So I believe it's primarily financial, you know, with a little stigma around this bipolar treatment that is preventing this from becoming more widespread and more actively researched on the part of the medical community.
Well, it's time to take a quick break. And when we return, we want to talk more about some of the mechanisms of action of how lithium works, and also some of the other work that Dr. Greenblatt's doing and his wonderful organization, Psychiatry Redefined. So stay with us as we talk more about lithium, the Cinderella nutrient. Stay with us.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called tham, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea. made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the natural medicine chest.
Welcome back to our guest, Dr. James Greenblatt. He's medical director of Psychiatry Redefined, and we're talking about lithium, the mental balance nutrient, its fabulous history, and its use as a modern-day drug, and also as a nutraceutical, as we say. So welcome back, Dr. Greenblatt. Let's talk a little bit about some of the more interesting biochemical research on lithium, kind of blocking these very inflammatory compounds that we see in the dementia brain. Like, for instance, they found that they have this area of the brain that has an enzyme called glycogen synthase kinase, which, and whenever we talk about these things, these are like important messenger molecules for regrowing the brain and healing the brain, actually. And they found out that lithium kind of modulates this. This is exciting research.
Absolutely. It is, again, as I described, overwhelming, the research that has come out around the what we call not only the anti-inflammatory, but the neuroregenerative properties of lithium. If we take an animal and create a lesion, adding lithium, it'll heal the brain more quickly. Or if they put lithium in before they did any damage to the brain, it prevented the lesion. So the anti-inflammatory properties, have implications for everything from traumatic brain injury to concussions, to a host of other inflammatory illnesses that affect the brain. Lyme disease, there are a number of Lyme literate docs who, low-dose lithium is one of the keys for preventing that kind of brain fog.
Brain fog, that's interesting. A lot of people suffer from that, and that's sort of an ill-defined where the patient has cognitive deficits. Sometimes they forget why they walked into a room or what they just read or what they were going to say. I guess if it gets pretty bad like that. So lithium actually has been shown to help those damaged nerve cells and actually change the amount of gray matter in the brain. So that is phenomenal there. I use a mushroom to help with that, the lion's mane mushroom, which I know is a botanical that seems to help with that. But this is exciting stuff with lithium, because this is, most baby boomers are aging, and this is sort of what we need to start looking at more in medicine, how to keep our aging population, including me, everyone else, baby boomers, around for a longer time and sharp mentally.
Yeah, there's a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And people refer to that as kind of miracle grow for the brain. When that is created, nerve cells kind of proliferate and repair themselves and, high levels associated with better memory and better mood. And lithium has been shown to increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor in a couple different ways, both the genes creating synthesis and keeping it around longer. So lithium has clear identified mechanisms for this anti-inflammatory and neuroregenerative properties.
Now, what's the best way, besides, of course, you know, you need to go see a practitioner to figure all this out there, but what's the best way that patients can find out how much lithium's in their body and if they need to take extra? And what are you shooting for when you actually analyze people's labs? I understand that using the hair sometimes, if it's a non-contaminated hair sample without dyes and bleaches and perms and other things like that, could yield some interesting clinical data on the body's reservoir of lithium.
Yes, I mean, it's hard to test. People run to their doctors and get a blood test, and that is not helpful. There should not be any lithium in the blood unless you're taking medicine. The hair, trace mineral hair test does provide us some guidance because we all should have some levels of lithium, and some of our patients have undetectable lithium, so that helps. But I think clinical history is really important. Family history is important. And I think everybody, certainly anybody over the age of 30, would be fine taking a couple milligrams. I think as people become more aware of lithium, people are taking higher dosages, 5, 10, 20 milligrams without any monitoring. And I wouldn't recommend that, but I do recommend 1 to 2 milligrams for anybody looking for kind of prevention of cognitive decline.
Does it interfere with any medications? You know, you read, like when I recommend it to people, immediately they check the e-medicine sites and what all the different sites out there. And of course, most of that information is on the lithium carbonate. And then they get back to me and they're, you know, scared to death, or they say it interacts with this or interacts badly with that, or not good for the kidneys, and the litany of things that's written on the lithium carbonate. How could you allay the anxiety of the listeners out there for a proper research on lithium? I guess going to your site is one of the best ways to do that. But
sure. And we had a major professional conference on lithium, and it was the first study done on toxicology of lithium orotate, the nutritional supplement, to demonstrate its safety. And again, the 1 to 2 milligrams that I recommend, it's what many people would get in their daily diet, what they would get in their tap water. So we're not talking about dosages that either interfere or would have a interaction with medications.
So at these subclinical doses, the lithium ions, they are working to balance the possibly the neurotransmitters, and then having this anti-inflammatory effect, preventing the bad damaging enzymes in the body. And you talked about the tau plaques and various tangles that occur in the brain. Anything else on lithium that people, what about mood, seasonal affective disorder, say, for instance, when people have seasonal affective disorder? Just anecdotally, since I've been taking the low dose lithium based on your work, I don't have seasonal affective disorder anymore. And usually come October, I'm feeling pretty down in the dumps. I'm not a winter person, but it definitely has had a tremendous effect on my mood and brain, as evidenced by my family too, anecdotally. So have you seen, tell us some stories from your practice as we get to the tail end of our program here. We have about 10 more minutes to go, on how lithium's changed people's lives.
Well, you know, when I give presentations, I have a slide where a big thank you card, and I can share, you know, with you 35 years of practice, I've never received more sincere thank you notes from somebody where lithium has kind of changed their life. And the stories go from, you know, these 4 and 5 year old kids that are kicked out of preschool for irritability and aggression. And these are preschools that the parents are paying for. So for someone to kick them out, the behaviors must be pretty significant. So from that young child irritability to adolescents who are cutting themselves, self-injury and anger control, to road rage, to what you're describing, just mood disorders that don't seem to be helped by other nutritional interventions, lithium can, you know, often be incredibly helpful. Now, it doesn't treat everything, and many times the patients we see might have other nutritional deficiencies, whether it's thyroid or B12 deficiency. But if you can identify a need for lithium, it can be a powerful foundation for providing kind of mental health.
Now, does it interact with, you're basically saying that this is the amount that you find in water should you live in a lithium area, in other words, an area where it's found in the groundwater, and there's, of course, some areas that have, have a bereft or the bereft of lithium in some areas where it's actually very high. But have you seen that there's any interaction with medications that people are on? Because, you know, you being a psychiatrist know what people are on, and you know, they might be on serotonin drugs, you know, SSRIs, and a whole host, a whole litany of other drugs affecting epinephrine and dopamine and whatnot. So we know lithium has a mood elevating activity by somehow modulating these neurotransmitters. So is there any problems with people using the lithium? And then you run into the second part of the question, you run into problems where if you tell a conventionally trained psychiatrist that your holistic practitioner is recommending lithium and they're not with the program, you might run into some obstacles. I mean, that's the practicality of what I see going on in medicine. Not everyone has consulted with the Dr. Greenblatt. So what's your take on the whole politics of it, as I call it, situation?
Yeah, no, it's really important. I think that the only thing someone should be most worried about would be someone with kidney disease. I would not be taking lithium without doctor supervision, and likely not at all. But we have found there's no interaction with medications with these lower dosages, you know, the 2 to 5 milligrams. You know, above that, I think it's always best to work with a practitioner who knows lithium. Again, over the years, more and more people are taking lithium, and I see Facebook groups devoted to people just taking lithium. I'm quite convinced that people are just taking too much. I mean, they're just taking pills and listening to YouTubers and taking 10, 20, 30, 40 milligrams and not really being monitored. So at the low dose, which I call between 2 and 5 milligrams, I see no interaction with psychiatric medications and really no concerns. At the higher dosages, you should work with someone who understands lithium.
And the literature and has clinical experience using it and things like that. So, yeah. Well, I wish we could hear more about it from the mainstream medical establishment. It seems like they might be reluctant to consider this incredible body of evidence supporting lithium's utility, but you kind of explained that there's not a lot of money into it unless they can patent the drug, which is, or the nutrient, which is, you know, kind of the age-old story of profit-driven pharmaceutical science. So is there any last, tell us where we could reach you and tell us a little bit about some of your other work in the psychiatric field. Besides just lithium, you do a whole host of other things for patients and training doctors, etc.
Yes, psychiatryredefined.org is the website for our professional training, and non-professionals are welcome to take the courses. The courses on lithium would be easy for anybody to know. The conference on lithium, a 2-day conference from experts around the world, is on the site, and that I think has been the highlight of my career. So Psychiatry Defined is where we provide courses and educational programs, and there are many, many free webinars on helping people understand that mental health outcomes can improve if we look for what we call an integrative and functional medicine model. There's just so much we can do. It doesn't have to be just medications.
Psychiatry redefined, all one word, no punctuation there, for the website to reach. And you can also go to Dr. Greenblatt's website, which is James, you know, www.jamesgreenblatt, G-R-E-E-N-B-L-A-T-T, capital M, capital D, MD.com. Dr. Greenblatt, this has been very interesting. I love the history and also the science behind this misunderstood mental balance nutrient. Thanks for sharing so much great information with the listeners here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Any parting words?
No. I just encourage everyone to read and to think with an open mind and join us in improving our current model for mental health treatment. Thanks for inviting me.
And go on your website to read a lot of the articles that you've done. Certainly done your homework, and there's all kind. And then if you don't believe it, go check the references. Put the references in PubMed, which is anyone can go to, by the way, and learn about the go to the National Institute of Medicine's website, which is PubMed, free, and then access medical literature from around the world. And Dr. Greenblatt's great because he can critique the article, shows its strength and weakness, because sometimes articles or studies are weak. Maybe they're not done long enough or there's some problems with it. And he's done a great job with that. I'm so excited because mental health is often stigmatized and people are often shunned. It's like you can call in to work, Dr. Greenblatt, right, with a bad back. But if you call in for a mental health day, your boss looks at you kind of strange.
Absolutely. We need to remove the stigma from getting mental health treatment and understand how important it is to our health and longevity.
Well, thank you very much. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We hope that you all stay healthy out there. Bye-bye.